audit the Fed. Much of the nation's monetary problems come from the Federal Reserve System. In a study entitled, "Is the Federal Reserve System a Governmental or a Privately Controlled Organization?" the American Monetary Institute, AMI, explained the confusion and ambiguity over the ownership and purpose of the Federal Reserve System, which is neither wholly a federal agency nor a completely private company. The AMI asserted that ambiguity of control has resulted in the monetary power being misused. It has allowed great power to be wielded without responsibility. No amount of false PR will change that. The money power vested in Congress by the Constitution has been improperly delegated to private interests without sufficient public interest benefit, if any. Congress must resume the power vested in it. Had such delegation of power been shown to work in the public interest, one could consider maintaining or adjusting the present system. But look what it has done. This calls for a major shifting of how our money system operates and is controlled. Anything less, with minor benefits that merely alleviate the problems temporarily, will allow the destructive process to eventually resume. The ambiguity must cease. AMI Director Stephen Zarlenga wrote that the Institute has been working on comprehensive legislation called the American Monetary Act, designed to resolve ambiguity over who controls the Fed. Rather than resorting to simple abolishment, the AMI's plan posits that the federal government should incorporate the Fed. Monetary reform is achieved in three parts, which must be enacted together for it to work. Any one or any two of them alone won't do it, but could actually further harm the monetary situation, Zarlenga explained. First, incorporate the Federal Reserve System into the U.S. Treasury, where all new money is created by government as money, not interest-bearing debt, and spent into circulation to promote the general welfare, monitored to be neither inflationary nor deflationary. Second, halt the bank's privilege to create money by ending the fractional reserve system in a gentle and elegant way. All the past monetized private credit is converted into U.S. government money. Banks then act as intermediaries, accepting savings deposits and loaning them out to borrowers, what people think they do now. Third, spend new money into circulation on infrastructure, including education and healthcare needed for a growing society, starting with the $1.6 trillion that the American Society of Civil Engineers estimates is needed for infrastructure repair, creating good jobs across our nation, reinvigorating local economies, and refunding government at all levels. Zarlenga noted that AMI's plan would not be supported except under emergency conditions. The idea is to have it ready and to inform enough citizens and lawmakers around the country about it, he wrote. At the same time, it is necessary to begin action now, and there is a small step called the Monetary Transparency Act. It starts the process of making the Fed more accountable to the Congress by requiring the compilation of certain statistics which are otherwise difficult to get. These are numbers which almost automatically point the way toward better public policy decisions. The statistics that Zarlenga noted are accessible through the little-known Comprehensive Annual Financial Reports, CAFRs. More than 84,000 CAFRs are completed each year by local governments in the United States, but only rarely does the public get a view of them. According to the veteran Wall Street commodity trader Walter Burian, every state, county, and major metropolitan city is keeping two sets of books. One, the budget, is commonly available and tracks each governmental entity's costs and tax revenue. The budget is the financial record that's seen by the public and used by the politicians to justify new governmental services and higher taxes, he said. However, the second set of books, the CAFR, is virtually unknown to the public but contains the real record of total governmental income. The budget gives an accurate account of government costs, according to Burian, but only the CAFR gives an accurate account of the government's income. The CAFR is the accounting Bible for all local government. It shows the total gross income, investment structure, and also shows the general purpose operating budget as is selectively created by your local government. I note that the selectively created operating budget usually amounts to one-third of the gross income and is where 100% of tax income is shown. The other two-thirds of the gross income is shown only in the CAFR report and is derived from return on investments and enterprise operations, of which said enterprise operations will have their own CAFR, or annual financial report listing their own investments and gross income separate from the local government they are under. Many games are played here. Burian explained tax cuts and CAFR hidden assets with this metaphor. The foxes have been riding the laws on how many chickens they can eat from the henhouse. At first, out of our 3,000 chickens, we gave the foxes 100 per year. They ate them and said they need 200. So we gave them 200. They ate them and then said they needed 400. So we gave them 400. But we started complaining, saying enough is enough. So the foxes said they needed 440. Justifying 440 with any logic available to them, but realizing we were complaining about giving them 100, then 200, then 400. So they, in their wisdom, started to put 150 aside each year in their own hen house, held by them and undisclosed to us. Well, after many a year in the fox's own hen house, they have collected 6,500 chickens. Total available revenue not tied in directly with the publicly known operating budget, as they continue to collect the now 510, the disclosed operating budget, as the foxes cry to us, saying they're barely getting by on the 510, but since we are complaining about the 510, they will cut back the annual take to 490 at great sacrifice to themselves, the foxes. Under this method of cooking the books, government entities from the federal to the state and even county level can store much more money than is reflected in the publicly available budgets. It is obvious that the inside player's crucial element for success was to make sure the people did not review, understand, or comprehend their financial game plan as it grew, explained Burian. To be able to pull this off, government required the full cooperation of the syndicated media, organized education, and the political parties. It is obvious they got it, and got it due to the money involved. If you cooperated, you were on easy street. If you did not, you were marginalized or worse. To correct this hidden government theft, citizens must first learn how much money their local government is hiding. Make sure all know to carefully look at, review, and examine their local government CAFRs. Avoidance or refusal by your local government to do so, in plain language, is treason and financial fraud by intentional non-disclosure of the worst sort. When all the people know to look, I am confident there are a few sharp cookies out there that can take the corrective measures necessary to reverse the game back into the benefit and control of the people. Bruce Wiseman, the U.S. National President of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, compared President Barack Obama's 2009 agreement to join the Financial Stability Board, FSB, which he signed at the G20 meeting in London, to the Bretton Woods agreements approved by representatives of 44 allied nations in July 1944. The result of Bretton Woods was an established monetary management system and the rules for international commercial and financial relations. Additionally, the agreements served as the foundation for creating the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Wiseman stated that President Obama's approval of the FSB, the Global Monetary Authority connected to the Bank for International Settlements, must be scrutinized carefully. Let your representatives and senators know the Financial Stability Board must be approved by Congress and must be subject to oversight by elected officials of the countries involved. Personal visits followed by calls and faxes to both Washington and local offices are the most effective. Don't be surprised if they don't know what you're talking about. Politely insist they find out and take action. And understand this when dealing with legislators or their staffs. They are focused almost exclusively on legislation that has already been introduced, a bill with a number on it. That is not the case here. You want them to take action on this matter by introducing legislation that brings the approval and structure of the Financial Stability Board under congressional control. Wiseman noted that there is nothing inherently evil about the International Financial Organization. It is a global world today, and a body that oversees the smooth flow and interchange of currencies and other financial instruments, such as the FSB, is needed in today's world. But the organization cannot be controlled by international bankers who are not answerable to the citizens of the countries in which they operate. It should be overseen by a senior-level group which itself is organized as a liberal republic, following the original model of the United States. The point is not to get Congress to approve what has been done. It is to first get them to recognize that agreements have been made that affect our entire financial system, and that it is their responsibility to shape these agreements in a way that is beneficial to our republic and to provide a mechanism for real oversight of this international body. Central bankers should not be making decisions about international finance without oversight and a system of checks and balances that are reflective of those provided by a republican form of government. For those states whose governments have mismanaged finances, history offers suitable lessons for revitalizing local economies. Most people probably haven't heard of a small island off the coast of England called Guernsey. After the Blitzkrieg, the Germans occupied the island and deported non-native islanders to German concentration camps. According to Toby Birch, managing director of Birch Assets Limited in Guernsey, the little-known history of Guernsey includes a great deal of monetary ingenuity. As weary troops returned from a protracted foreign war, the Napoleonic Wars, they encountered a land racked with debt, high prices, and a crumbling infrastructure, whose flood defenses were about to be overwhelmed. While 1815 brought an end to the conflict on the battlefront, however, severe austerity ensued on the home front. The application of the gold standard meant that loans issued over many years were then recalled to balance the ratio of money to precious metals. This led to economic gridlock, as labor and materials were abundant, but much-needed projects could not be funded for want of cash. This led to a period of so-called poverty amongst plenty. A committee was formed to find a way out of the situation. Like all great ideas, the principles were straightforward, Birch noted. The committee realized that if the Guernsey states issued their own notes to fund the project, rather than borrowing from an English bank, there would be no interest to pay. This would lead to substantial savings, because as anyone with a mortgage should understand, the debtor ends up paying at least double the amount borrowed over the long term. The irresponsible creation of credit is a dangerous game that temporarily benefits the current generation, but steals from the next. A lesson that has been forgotten yet again in modernity. To bring balance to the equation, therefore, the people of Guernsey had to find a way to neutralize such deficits while neither contracting nor expanding the money supply. On a purely practical level, this was achieved by adding a sell-by date to the notes in issue, rather like a maturity date on a bond. For example, on a note issued 21 November 1827, it promises to pay the bearer £1 on the 1st of October 1830. This begs the question as to how the future obligation was to be honored, but again, a simple mechanism was implemented whereby rent from the resulting infrastructure and tax revenues on liquor was set aside into a sinking fund to pay off the interest-free borrowing. The end result of the Guernsey experiment was spectacular. New roads, sea defenses, and public buildings were established, fostering widespread trade and prosperity. Full employment was achieved, no deficits resulted, and prices were stable, all without a penny paid in interest. What started as a trial led to a string of construction projects, which still stand and function to this day. Money was used in its purest form as a convenient mechanism for oiling the wheels of commerce and development. But Birch also noted that there was a fly in the ointment. One would have thought that everyone would be happy with such a success story, but this was not the case. When you open a closed shop to competition, those with vested interests become highly protective. In those days, it was the private banks who were threatened, because they were cut out of the equation. No loans meant no interest and no profit margin. So they may well have been the source of a mysterious complaint made to England's Privy Council, which put a ceiling on the issuance of Guernsey notes for the next century. Why should we pay attention to a situation on a small British isle almost 200 years ago? Whenever stimulus packages, tax rebates, or bank bailouts are paraded as solutions to the credit crisis, they are actually part and parcel of its very cause, explained Birch. It all stems from the quick-fix approach of producing money out of thin air and leaving it for the next generation to pay off. This has been going on in the United States since, at the very least, the Vietnam War, when the last vestige of monetary restraint was cast aside. In abandoning gold as a check on the money supply, the U.S. freed the world from financial discipline. The dissolution of the dollar has been evident ever since. Birch said banks still have a role to play in providing liquidity by matching investors with borrowers, but they can no longer be trusted with the unrestrained creation of credit. The Guernsey experiment showed that simple ideas can work wonders, he said. They simply require an unselfish philosophy and a desire to do the right thing for future generations, much like America's founding fathers. To disengage from the inflated national economy and to bolster local businesses, some Americans are experimenting with their own money. One instance of this is the Berkshire system, a local currency that has circulated in the Berkshires area of Massachusetts since 2006. According to the Berkshire website, nearly 400 businesses in the Berkshire area accept Berkshires, which are printed on special paper, including security features. Labeled a great economic experiment by the New York Times, Berkshires are a tool for community empowerment, enabling merchants and consumers to plant the seeds for an alternative economic future for their communities. The Berkshire website proclaims, five different banks have participated with Berkshires, with a total of 13 branch offices now serving as exchange stations. For Berkshires, this is only the beginning. Future plans could involve Berkshire checking accounts, electronic transfer of funds, ATM machines, and even a loan program to facilitate the creation of new local businesses manufacturing more of the goods that are used locally. Fire Congress. Our government, partially modeled after that of the Greeks, once flourished as a republican democracy. Yet, under recent authority, our government has devolved into a dichotomy of socialism and capitalism, melding public ownership and private ownership. Capitalism brings wealth to individuals who work hard, while socialism brings wealth to those in control, who lie to get elected. For example, no new taxes, G.H.W. Bush, 1988. Change you can believe in, Obama, 2008. In virtually every case, capitalism yields more wealth for an individual than needed. To resolve the discrepancy between those who have too much and those who have nothing, the capitalists invented charity, a product of religious morality. The globalists devalued individual charity decades ago by suppressing the free exercise of religion and by replacing private charity with government charity. Those who promised the most charity to the people got elected to public office. This leads to a nation where a majority of non-producers are in charge of the producers. As a growing number of people realize that life is easier as a non-producer, more and more people strive for jobs as non-producers. In the end, there are fewer people left to produce. This is the ultimate failure of socialism, and appropriately accounts for the collapse of Soviet communism. America's elected Congress has allowed more and more non-producers to live off the largesse of fewer and fewer producers. Today, adding government retirees, the disabled, Medicare, and Social Security to the welfare recipients, there are more Americans living off the government than paying into it. Although no compassionate person is advocating cutting programs to those truly in need, The national budget must be trimmed, and Congress appears unwilling or unable to do so. In 2009 and 2010, a plan was offered to send an indelible message to Congress that the taxpayers want serious change. Fire Congress. Many believe that such a plan may be the only way to effect real change in government. Several websites and organizations sprang up advocating voting out every incumbent in Congress. To borrow famous words, generally attributed to Mark Twain, politicians are like diapers. They need to be changed often, and for the same reason. Anticipation for drastic change has been coming for decades. Wright Patman, who was chairman of the House Committee on Banking and Currency for more than 16 years, predicted in 1941 that the public would demand a drastic change in Congress due to its monetary policies. Patman said, "I have never yet had anyone who could, through the use of logic and reason, justify the government borrowing the use of its own money. I believe the time will come when people will demand that this be changed. I believe the time will come in this country when they will actually blame you and me and everyone else connected with the Congress for sitting idly by and permitting such an idiotic system to continue." In early 2009, Rasmussen Reports, a firm that distributes public opinion polling information, reported that corporate CEOs were the least favorably regarded professionals among a list of professional groups that included bankers, lawyers, and small business owners. But in September, Congress took the honor of being the least favored. 72% view them unfavorably, stated the Rasmussen News release. There's some intensity in that perception, too. Only 4% have a very favorable view of congressmen, while 37% view them very unfavorably. Even 56% of Democrats have an unfavorable view of Congress, although their party controls both the House and the Senate. Of course, their opposition pales next to the 86% of Republicans and 81% of adults not affiliated with either party who have an unfavorable opinion of Congress. But then voters are evenly divided over whether a group of people randomly selected from the phone book would do a better job than the current Congress. As Obama's promised change we can believe in failed to materialize in 2009, a movement to throw out Congress began to gain strength. The website for an organization called Kick Them All Out reads, "Presidents have no constitutional authority to do most of the things they claim they can do. They can only ask the Congress to do what they want. The Congress could have stopped everything that's happening, the wars, the Wall Street takeover, the trillion-dollar defense budget they just passed. Our so-called representatives have sold us out so many times it makes my head spin, and what do we all do? We not only let them keep their jobs, but you watch, they will most likely give themselves a raise, like they always do. The Congress critters work for us, not the central bankers and transnational corporations. What would you do if you owned a company and none of your employees listened to you? They lied to you, didn't do the jobs you gave them to do, and in fact, were actually working for your competition and selling your company down the river as fast as they could. I don't think you'd keep them on and give them a raise. Well, that's exactly what we've been doing, only in this case, your company is our federal government, and your employees are the 435 members in the House of Representatives and the 100 members of the Senate, virtually all of them working for the transnational corporations, the competition, and they have already achieved a hostile takeover of our government on every level and are using the powers of our own government against us in order to take over our entire nation. What the heck happened to that thing called the wisdom of the American people? You don't reward employees that betray you. You fire them." The Kick Them All Out website offers free posters of the famous Uncle Sam painting by James Montgomery Flagg. But in this rendition, an artist has changed the slogan to read, "I want you to kick them all out. Do your patriotic duty and show Congress who the boss is." A similar group from Texas is calling to empty Congress of its incumbents. Formed by Houston native Tim Cox, the group is called Go, Get Out of Our House, and as of 2009, had 2,000 members in Houston and 100,000 outside the city. According to one Houston TV station, ABC affiliate KTRK, the group might succeed in its goal, as a poll conducted by the station showed 47% of respondents reported they were no longer aligned with a political party. Some observers feel this number may be reflected in other parts of the country and signifies a movement away from the two-party system. WorldNetDaily.com, a conservative online website headquartered in Washington, D.C., offered its readers the opportunity to send actual pink slips to specific members of Congress, warning that if they vote for more spending, socialized medicine, cap-and-trade legislation, and a hate crimes measure, they would not be reelected in 2010. WorldNet Daily claimed to have distributed as many as 3 million slips in a two-week period. I believe this campaign, already tremendously successful beyond my wildest expectations, can have a real impact on politicians whose first priority is getting reelected, said WND's editor and CEO Joseph Farah. Slightly less radical groups are trying to shake up the status quo through legislation. The Fire Congress Meetup Group's effort looks for members to join more than 200,000 Americans and impose de facto term limits on all U.S. congressmen and senators, regardless of party affiliation or whatever they promise. Kick them all out so the new ones finally hear us, stated the Fire Congress's website. One internet wag recommended limit all U.S. politicians to two terms, one in office, one in prison. Term limits is another idea that has been brought up in the past as a means to curtail congressional power. Though creditable legislators have made such proposals in the past, the very people affected by the change, the members of Congress, have always voted the bills down. U.S. Term Limits, USTL, headquartered in Fairfax, Virginia, claims to be the leader of what the organization's creators describe as the largest grassroots movement in American history. According to the USTL website, the organization has placed term limits proposals into 15 state legislatures. 8 of the 10 largest cities in America adopted term limits for their city councils and/or mayor, and 37 states placed term limits on their constitutional officers, stated USTL literature. American politicians, special interests, and lobbyists continue to combat term limits, as they know term limits force out career politicians who are more concerned with their own gain than the interests of the American people. Remember, every town councilman wants to be a congressman, every congressman wants to be a senator, and every senator wants to be president. At WeShouldFireCongress.com, the message is the same. It's time we send a message straight to Congress. Do your job or you're fired, states literature on the website. This site raises money to place billboards across the nation urging voters to fire Congress. All of these organizations and websites implore Americans to vote for America, not a political party. Though the imperatives from these organizations resonate with many voters, when election time rolls around, many voters will continue to vote for the same old faces and political parties. The question naturally arises, why don't more progressives and independents run for public office? It would seem as if the progressives or independents would receive votes from those dissatisfied with Congress. Yet this does not occur because progressives and independents are tied down, trying to survive in a society in which the love of money has superseded the love of their fellow human being. To be specific, to win public office in any large city or state, a candidate must have television and radio broadcast time. Purchasing this time is expensive, and often media outlets want cash in advance for political ads. Additionally, there are the costs of producing a professional-looking and effective ad. This is an expense that goes far beyond hand-painted posters and yard signs. It can run into the thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. If candidates still want to succeed, they must ally themselves with one of the two major political parties and look for Corporate or Political Action Committee, PAC money. This need for a huge stockpile of cash prevents most honorable and honest people from competing in the political campaign process. Most candidates, especially at the local and state level, simply do not have the kind of money it takes to produce and air an influential advertisement. George Green once raised campaign funds for Jimmy Carter and was asked to be Carter's campaign finance chairman. I remember being flown to Aspen in a private jet and then being asked to be the Democratic finance chairman for the Carter election, Green said in a 2006 interview. I remember then saying I was a Republican, and then Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Board of Governors of the U.S. Federal Reserve System and North American chairman of the Trilateral Commission, leaned over and said, "That's okay, kid. It doesn't matter. We control them both." Based on Green's words, as well as the evidence detailed earlier in this work, it should be clear now that the same secret society globalists control both the Democratic and Republican parties. This may be why people often call our members of Congress the best representatives that money can buy. The biggest problem in our government is corporate power, and with that, the huge amount of resources and political power taken by the military. Until we deal with those issues, we will go nowhere in this country on health care, the environment, social justice, or anything else of importance, said Harvey Wasserman, an author, a journalist, and an energy activist. People should now understand that while it's been monumentally important to finally have an African American as president, a woman will come next, it's now more important to have someone who is not a Republican or a Democrat, and who is committed to the welfare of the public rather than that of the corporations. One possible way to curtail the abuses on the election process would be to outlaw TV ads for prospective candidates, which would in many ways take money out of the equation. This would allow interested voters to learn about candidates through debates, newspaper articles, or printed flyers outlining candidate positions and policies. Political candidates would get radio and TV airtime through talk show or journalistic interviews open to all candidates. Such interviews could open political debates to alternative ideas and less mudslinging. Another good way of culling out greedy or financially sponsored politicians is to vote for the candidate with the least money. This person may not be any less susceptible to corruption, but it is a sure sign the individual has not sold out for campaign funds. As Bernard Baruch, the financier and political consultant to Presidents Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, once advised, "Vote for the man who promises least, he'll be the least disappointing." Once the incumbent politicians have been turned out of office and a new crop arrives in Washington, the public must scrutinize their every move. The public must force them to consider term limits and to do away with their private retirement funds. Place Congress on Social Security and watch how fast it is cleaned up and well-funded. Only when Congress members act suitably for the public should they be voted back into Congress. This is not a revolutionary idea. It's the way the system is supposed to work. Unfortunately, this system is predicated on the idea that there is an alert and educated electorate, and that the voting mechanism is honest and fair. Poll watchers and paper ballots. Zombies don't vote. Only about half of the eligible electorate cast ballots in recent presidential elections. In 2008, this dismal record was turned around when 62% of eligible voters cast ballots, the highest turnout since the 1960 campaign between John F. Kennedy and Richard M. Nixon. Though this percentage looks impressive, one must consider the average voter turnout in comparable European nations. Italy, 93%. Germany, 81%. Spain, 77%. And the United Kingdom and Ireland, 75%. The comedian W.C. Fields once said, "Hell, I never vote for anyone. I always vote against." Nowadays, people still don't vote for anyone. They simply pull the lever or touch the screen for their political party, holding little regard for the issues or the quality of their party's candidate. This method of voting may be due to the fact that far too many voters feel that neither of the two candidates in an election stand for their ideals. Instead of voting for a person, many voters feel they must vote against the lesser of two evils, which still means they are voting for an evil. Once you don't vote your ideals, that has serious undermining effects. It erodes the moral basis of our democracy, opined unsuccessful presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Consider the presidential election of 2004. Voters had the option of the Republican candidate George W. Bush, the scion of a rich family and a member of the secret society Skull and Bones, or Bush's cousin, Democratic candidate John Kerry, the scion of a rich family and a member of the secret society Skull and Bones. Most informed and thoughtful people did not consider this much of a choice. What could be worse than having two bad presidential choices? Not even being able to choose between the two. President Franklin Roosevelt said, "Nobody will ever deprive the American people of the right to vote except the American people themselves, and the only way they could do this is by not voting." But then Roosevelt had no way of knowing that voters could be disenfranchised by computers and voting machine fraud. As Boris Bazhenov notes in Memoirs of Stalin's Former Secretary, Joseph Stalin once proclaimed, "I consider it completely unimportant who will vote or how, but what is extraordinarily important is this, who will count the votes and how." Until very recently, votes were cast with paper ballots under the watch of poll watchers, someone appointed by a candidate, a political party, or supporters or opponents of a particular measure to observe the election procedures in a given precinct, watching for any voting irregularities. Watchers and voters may not converse within the polling place, nor are watchers permitted to interfere with the orderly conduct of the election or influence any voter. Poll watchers have largely been outmoded by electronic voting machines, which are fundamentally just computers. The Help America Vote Act was signed into law by President Bush in 2002. It was intended to streamline and improve voting methods, such as eliminating the punch card ballots that had caused so much trouble in the 2000 Florida election, setting standards for the training of poll workers, and upgrading to electronic voting machines. But effecting these changes was left up to the individual states, which resulted in varying interpretations and effectiveness. There has been a great deal of controversy over the use of electronic voting machines that display ballots and record and tabulate votes. Advocates of using machines claim such machines are fast, accurate, and easy to set up for disabled and non-English-speaking voters. Yet there are problems with the machines. Critics claim voting machines have many technical problems that could lead to inaccuracy and hacking. The touchscreen models are a special concern since some models do not provide a paper record of the votes, which might be necessary in the case of a manual recount. Researcher Bev Harris, founder of the national nonpartisan nonprofit elections watchdog group Black Box Voting Incorporated, wrote, "Our voting system, which is part of the public commons, has recently been privatized. When this happened, the counting of the votes, which must be a public process, subjected to the scrutiny of many eyes of plain old citizens, became a secret." In 2003, Bev Harris obtained internal memos from Diebold, which used to be one of the major manufacturers of electronic voting systems. Some of the internal memos documented that uncertified software was being used in its voting machines and that Diebold programmers intentionally bypassed the certification system. She posted the memos on the internet. Though Diebold claimed Harris's action constituted copyright infringement, a California U.S. district judge forced Diebold to relent in October 2004 when the judge ruled that Diebold had abused its copyright privileges while trying to suppress the embarrassing memos. In 2007, Diebold changed the name of its election division to Premier Election Solutions Incorporated, PES, following a spate of bad publicity. On September 3, 2009, Election Systems and Software, ES&S, announced that it would purchase PES, which means that America is now provided voting machines by only three companies, ES&S, Sequoia Voting Systems, and Hart InterCivic. Many viewed ES&S's acquisition as creating a near monopoly over the voting machines widely used throughout the country. Election Systems and Software's $5 million acquisition of Diebold Incorporated's voting machine company amounts to a near monopoly, cried an editorial in the Miami Herald. The state of Florida during the 2000 presidential election learned the hard way that touchscreen voting did not reassure voters that their ballots were being counted because the machines left no independently verifiable paper trail. Of the ES&S purchase, Harvey Wasserman said, "The ES&S purchase of Diebold PES is indicative of a larger problem between the two of them. They control 80% of the touchscreen machines in the U.S., Both are corrupt GOP-dominated corporations, so the idea that just one of them will be in control doesn't matter that much, although it has been a positive to see so much attention paid to the situation. Party politics aside, it should be clear that the consolidation of the nation's voting process into only a few hands offers the appearance of opportunity for, if not actual, vote manipulation. According to Wasserman, what is more troublesome than a voting machine monopoly is the use of the machines in the first place. Wasserman believes that all electronic voting machines, tabulators, etc., should be banned. We need universal automatic voter registration and universal paper ballots that are hand-counted. Simple as that. Until we get there, there is no reason to believe any election in this country will be a reliable reflector of the popular will. Wasserman also advocated universal automatic registration and a national holiday for voting and for vote counting, to give working people an equal opportunity to vote. Diebold's voting machines have long been controversial. Following investigations over Diebold's voting machines, California banned one Diebold model from the state in 2004. California decertified some voting machines again in 2007, after it was learned through an open-source ballot counting program that 197 ballots had been silently dropped from voting machines in Humboldt County. Investigators conducted a top-to-bottom review of voting machines. At the conclusion of the investigation in 2009, Secretary of State Deborah Bowen decertified Diebold's Global Election Management System, GEMS, version 1.18.10 software program, and three other electronic voting systems. They cannot be used in California. In March 2009, Diebold PES's problems became much larger when the firm admitted in a Sacramento hearing that audit logs produced by its tabulation software could miss significant events such as the deletion of votes. The company acknowledged that the problem existed with every version of its tabulation software, even those used in other states. Vote counting GEM software is used to tabulate votes cast on every Premier Diebold touchscreen or optical scan machine in more than 1,400 election districts in 31 states. "Today's hearing confirmed one of my worst fears," said Kim Alexander, founder and president of the nonprofit California Voter Foundation. Alexander noted, "The audit logs, a program that monitors additions and deletions to the operating program, have been the top selling point for vendors hawking paperless voting systems. They and the jurisdictions that have used paperless voting machines have repeatedly pointed to the audit logs as the primary security mechanism and fail-safe for any glitch that might occur on machines. To discover that the fail-safe itself is unreliable eliminates one of the key selling points for electronic voting security." In 2007, the Maryland General Assembly voted for paper ballots counted by optical scanners to replace paperless touchscreen voting machines. But the plan fell apart in 2008 when a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives didn't approve an Election Assistance Commission program to provide the necessary states' funds for the purchase of paper ballots as a backup to voting machines. In other words, efforts to return to paper ballots have been blocked at the federal level. Could this be because the New World Order socialists, sometimes national socialists, sometimes Marxist socialists, have gained control over the federal apparatus? Wits have said that if God intended for us to vote, he would have given us candidates. It can likewise be said that if we were intended to have fair voting, we would have hard copy paper ballots that could remain for years in case of the need for a recount. Enforce the 10th Amendment. The federal government today can wage wars without the consent of congressional representatives, overthrow foreign governments, tax nearly half of national income, abolish civil liberty in the name of homeland security and the war on drugs, legalize and endorse infanticide, partial birth abortion, regulate nearly every aspect of our existence, and there's little or nothing we can do about it. "Right your congressman" is the refrain of the slave to the state who doesn't even realize he's a slave, thanks to decades of government school brainwashing. These were the observations of Thomas J. DiLorenzo, a professor of economics at Loyola College in Maryland, and the author of How Capitalism Saved America and Hamilton's Curse, How Jefferson's Arch Enemy Betrayed the American Revolution, and What It Means for America Today. DiLorenzo noted that, until 1865, the Supreme Court's opinion was just the Supreme Court's opinion. The citizens of the states reserved the right to offer their own opinions on constitutionality, which they often considered to be every bit as valid as the courts. President Woodrow Wilson, who one might recall was placed into power by Wall Street financiers, the forerunners of today's globalists, argued against states having the power to determine constitutionality in his 1908 book, Constitutional Government in the United States, writing, "The war between the states, which ended in 1865, established this principle, that the federal government is, through its courts, the final judge of its own powers." Beginning with the 2008 election of Barack Obama, state legislators began acting less subservient to the federal government as many citizens joined the 10th Amendment movement to rally against too much federal control. Members of the movement argue that the Constitution's 10th Amendment clearly states the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. In late September 2009, the Ohio State Senate passed Senate Concurrent Resolution 13, SCR 13, which was meant to claim sovereignty over certain powers pursuant to the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America, to notify Congress to limit and end certain mandates, and to insist that federal legislation contravening the 10th Amendment be prohibited or repealed. The Ohio State Senate was the 8th state senate behind Alaska, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Tennessee to pass a resolution reaffirming state sovereignty. By October 2009, 10th Amendment resolutions had been introduced in 37 state senates. Oklahoma State Representative Charles Key compared the resolution he authored for Oklahoma to a cease and desist order given by a landlord to a non-paying tenant. "If you've got a tenant that's not paying rent, you don't just show up one day with an empty truck," said Key. "First, you serve notice. That's how we see these resolutions, as a notice to the federal government. And there definitely will be follow-up." Supporters of the resolutions say that they are a long overdue first step in moving the country toward a constitutional government. The 10th Amendment is similar to a portion of the Articles of Confederation, which were written before the Constitution. A provision of the Articles states, "Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled." Although states have long grumbled about the enforcement of federal laws, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled only twice on 10th Amendment cases in modern times. In 1992, the court found that the Low-Level Radioactive Waste Policy Amendments Act of 1985 was unconstitutional, enforcing the states to retain and assume liability for radioactive waste. In 1997, the Supreme Court ruled that the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act unconstitutionally required state and local enforcement officials to conduct background checks on persons attempting to purchase handguns. Both cases involved only narrow and defined interpretations of the 10th Amendment. Indicating the High Court will not hasten to clarify the overall intention of this basic constitutional revision. This is similar to the court's refusal to hear arguments that the penalties imposed by the IRS on those who fail to file a 1040 tax form, which can be used by the prosecution in tax cases, are a direct violation of the Fifth Amendment, which states that persons cannot be compelled to give evidence against themselves. As noted by both Professor DiLorenzo and President Wilson, the war between the states temporarily settled the argument over whether local representatives elected by the citizens or some federal bureaucrat in Washington would rule over the public. Today, there is virtually no law or ordinance passed anywhere in the United States that cannot be overturned or superseded by federal authorities. If one questions this, Just ask the medical marijuana shops in California that were raided by the feds even after California voters approved such sales for medical purposes in 1996. Rather than passing resolutions to simply reaffirm their sovereignty, some states pushed for specific freedoms. In 2009, Montana and Tennessee passed Firearms Freedom Act legislation to declare that any firearms made and retained in state are beyond the authority of Congress under its constitutional power to regulate commerce among the states. 10 other states considered similar legislation. After the legislation passed, officials from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, BATFE, sent letters to gun dealers and federal firearm permit holders in both states. The letter stated that the dealers and permit holders should ignore the state law. Clearly, the contest for state regulation of firearms will continue in higher courts. Disputes between the government and the states aren't just limited to firearms. Voters in Alaska, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington voted on and passed legislation permitting marijuana use for medical purposes. But federal authorities have looked down on these laws, even though they were voted on by the majority of those state citizens. In 1996, medical marijuana was legalized in California after Proposition 215 passed by a 56% citizen vote. Regardless, marijuana remained illegal at the federal level by the Controlled Substances Act, which has led to a number of disputes. In 2005, a California woman sued the Drug Enforcement Administration after her medical marijuana crop was seized and destroyed by federal agents. Citing a constitutional clause that grants the federal government the power to regulate interstate commerce, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that even though the woman grew pot strictly for her own consumption and had never sold any, growing one's own marijuana affects the interstate market of marijuana. The court warned that homegrown marijuana for medical purposes could nevertheless, even inadvertently, enter the stream of interstate commerce. On the basis of this argument, the judges deemed that the federal actions of the Drug Enforcement Agency were warranted. Regardless of the Supreme Court's decision, an editorial in the September 21, 2009 edition of the San Francisco Examiner dealing with concerns over the Real ID Act, firearms, and marijuana laws, and even the healthcare debate proclaimed, "State sovereignty supporters stand on solid historical grounds. James Madison's Virginia Plan, which would have given Congress veto power with state laws and allowed the federal judiciary to hear all disputes, was soundly defeated by the signers of the Constitution. A needed check on an overreaching federal government that grows bigger by the day, the reassertion of state sovereignty should be a welcome development to Americans concerned about losing their liberties, just like the founders were." On February 1, 2010, 5 Democrats in the Virginia State Senate broke ranks with their party to endorse bills prohibiting compulsory government health care. 3 bills protecting Virginians from being forced to buy federally mandated health care were approved on 23-17 votes in the Virginia Senate, where Democrats have a 22-18 majority. If approved, Virginia would join Arizona as the second state to pass measures in defying such federal legislations. Senator Frederick M. Quayle, sponsor of one of the 3 proposals, argued that the federal government does not have the constitutional authority to require individuals to buy anything. "This is not a bill that deals with health care. It is a bill that attempts to reinforce the Constitution of the United States," he explained. It remains to be seen how successful states will be in regaining their sovereignty. Regardless, there are some encouraging signs. Beginning with Maine in 2007, nearly 25 states have passed legislation opposing the Real ID Act, which mandated federally approved identification. The act was passed in 2005 and was to go into effect in 2008, but was not enforced by 2010. Many governors scorn the responsibility and cost of ensuring that those who hold driver's licenses are citizens or legal residents of the United States. It is clear to many that more state sovereignty is achievable in the near future. Supporters of the 10th Amendment movement point to successful actions against the Real ID Act, as well as the legalization of medical marijuana in 13 states, as proof that with enough state-level resistance, the federal government may have no option but to back off, with or without judicial approval. There is also a good chance that when states are able to freely practice sovereignty, we will find practical, profitable, and safe alternatives to our current dependence on petrochemicals. As new energy sources become available, the globalists who profit from monopolies on gas and oil will have to diversify their products and begin to market alternatives. 20 years ago, we were told that solar energy was a viable alternative, but that the necessary harnessing technology wouldn't be available for 20 years. Now that 20 years have passed, one must ask, where's the solar energy? It has been estimated that the sun provides between 10,000 and 20,000 times more energy than we use on a given day. In order to use this energy, we need to learn how to collect it and put it to work. The fact that we haven't learned how to collect this energy should no longer be blamed on technology. Rather, what is at fault is stubbornness. The lack of will on the part of corporate business and its hired politicians in Congress. There is even a fundamental disconnect in the thinking of schooled energy experts. For example, one solar expert explained that it would take solar collector panels covering the state of Arizona to produce enough electricity to power the city of Los Angeles. Although this may be true, the expert based his conclusion on the faulty assumption that central generation was necessary to produce electricity for the city. Few power experts can visualize that by simply placing solar collectors on every rooftop in Los Angeles, the city could become largely energy independent. This independence could mean that electric bills would be cut in half or more. The only real problem would be for the monopoly utility companies. They could not place a cloud over a homeowner who failed to pay the monthly electric bill. But advances in alternative energy slowly continue to move forward. In October 2009, Suniva announced plans to transform some Michigan farmland near Saginaw into a 200,000-square-foot solar manufacturing facility. The announcement was made by Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, who said that the $250 million project could create 500 jobs during the coming years. Local business leaders call the project a much-needed economic boost for the whole region. We have generations of skilled manufacturers here, and we have people that understand the manufacturing industry, said Saginaw Future Incorporated President Joanne Crary. Though Suniva is hoping to break ground in 2010, it was having trouble securing financing for the project. Even some of the corporate giants seem to be jumping on the alternative energy bandwagon. In October 2009, Dow Chemical announced its innovative Powerhouse Solar Shingle, which company officials hoped would boost solar energy use by homeowners in the coming years. The Powerhouse Solar Shingle incorporates photovoltaic solar collecting and generating technology into a roof shingle. This allows people to use their entire rooftop to generate electricity at a reasonable cost. Dow officials said the new solar shingles will be on the market in limited quantities in 2010, and more widely available in 2011. With the advent and implementation of these new technologies, Americans must commit to new ways of thinking about energy. With apologies to Edmund Burke, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good zombies to do nothing. Nonviolent noncompliance. Strengthening the power of the central government will not solve many of the country's central public issues, especially that of public health care. The government has failed over and over with so many federal programs. How can the public remain confident in a health care program built by the government amid a financial crisis? One unsigned message circulating on the internet bluntly presented the truth in this manner. The U.S. Postal Service was established in 1775. They've had 234 years to get it right. It is broke, and even though heavily subsidized, it can't compete with private sector FedEx and UPS services. The U.S. Postal Service will lose over $7 billion this year and will require yet another bailout. Social Security was established in 1935. They've had 74 years to get it right. It is broke. There is nothing in the Social Security Trust Fund except IOUs from the government. Fannie Mae was established in 1938. They've had 71 years to get it right. It is broke. Freddie Mac was established in 1970. They've had 39 years to get it right. It is broke. Together, Fannie and Freddie have now led the entire world into the worst economic collapse in 80 years. The War on Poverty was started in 1964. They've had 45 years to get it right. $1 trillion of our hard-earned money is confiscated each year and transferred to the poor. It hasn't worked. Amtrak was established in 1970. They've had 39 years to get it right. In 2008, the government bailed it out as it continues to run at a loss. Medicare and Medicaid were established in 1965. They've had 44 years to get it right. They are both broke. And now our government, the Obama administration, dares to mention them as models for all U.S. health care. This is the government at work, and they now want to run the most complex economic program they have ever tackled, our health care system. The secret here is that the government is not the problem, nor is the Constitution on which it's founded. The problem lies in the people who control the government, the New World Order global fascists who now have a chokehold on the government. Their corporate money controls all three branches of government, while their associates are appointed to cabinet-level positions of authority. Recall that the Obama administration is top-heavy with members of the Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, and Bilderberg Group. The states do not have to follow the schemes and dictates of these plutocratic globalists, nor does the general public. The path to independence from government control does not need violence. The people of India did not gain independence by battling the British Army in the field. African Americans did not gain freedom by waging war against the government. In both instances, they simply practiced nonviolent noncompliance. Though it is not often mentioned in the corporate mass media, the more literate citizens are opting out of the New World Order control box. There is a widespread but underreported anti-tax movement, with millions of Americans simply refusing to voluntarily pay taxes for purposes they can't support. Naturally, the number of these resistors are rarely, if ever, given in the mass media, which nevertheless routinely reports on IRS crackdowns, usually about tax time. Convicted tax cheats garner major headlines, while victories over the IRS get scant coverage, if any at all. Yet small victories over the New World Order are taking place all the time. Citizens in both big cities and small towns are growing neighborhood gardens, supplementing fast food with organic and healthy vegetables and fruits. Most religious institutions today stock large pantries where food can be distributed to the poor, relieving strain on the welfare system. Those concerned about the environment are serving as examples to others in ways to lessen human impact. Recycling trash, riding bicycles, supporting mass transit, and driving the new hybrid or totally electric cars. Their demand for non-polluting, energy-efficient vehicles is now being met by customer-seeking corporations. Everyone can make a difference. If one person stops to pick up some trash on the street and places it in a receptacle, others notice, and some will be prompted to action.